morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. In today's program, we're going to be speaking to Ellen Augustine, who is one of the contributors to the book called A Game as Old as Empire, The Secret World of Economic Hitmen and the Web of Global Corruption, and that's published by Barrett Kohler Publishers, and it's the sequel to the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which came out a couple of years ago and which was a stunning hit. Before that, we are going to ask you, in fact, I am asking you, to go to your telephones and dial 428-1393 in order to keep this interview and others like it and others unlike it on the air on this program. 428-1393 is the number. This is our pledge drive. We wouldn't do it if we didn't have to. We do have to. That means you got to basically put your money where your mouth is. All of those who have said to me, oh, I love your program, call now, 428-1393. I'd like to welcome Charlie Romney Brown. She is the founder of Women's Voices, and she's here to basically tell us and to tell you why she listens to and supports KSFR.
KSFR is a community treasure. I've lived many places and have never found a radio station that so enriches my life.
Is that right?
And that of the community. Absolutely. Absolutely. Where else can you instantly tap into what's going on in the world and in Santa Fe? It's hourly BBC news keeps you in touch with what's going on internationally, and programs such as Mary Charlotte's Radio Cafe tells you what's going on in Santa Fe. That's a priceless combination, Mary Charlotte.
Well, thank you. And can you make a call out to your friends who might be listening right now?
Oh, yes. Everyone, please, for members of Women's Voices and of the literary community and everyone whose lives maybe Women's Voices has touched, please make a contribution to KSFR now. We would really appreciate it.
428-1393 is the number. I mean, I think the words community resource really go to the heart of what we're talking about here. Some places have a community center, mm-hmm. and the community center gets built by everybody pitching in. Usually it's through taxation, so everybody pitches in involuntarily because mm-hmm. they have to pay their taxes. This is a community resource that gets built voluntarily. That, on the one hand, makes it harder. And on the other hand, it makes it stronger because everybody who pitches in really has a stake in it.
That's absolutely true, you know. Whenever I'm driving, I have the radio on. There's no question about it. I'm getting information. It's wonderful. We have this instantaneous touch with something like KSFR, which is, as I say, keeping us abreast of what's going on in the world and here in Santa Fe. That's a macrocosm and the microcosm.
That's right.
What more can you ask?
That's true. That's a nice way of looking at it. 428-1393 is the number. We don't talk about pledge amounts all that much. You can pledge. I mean, there's a lovely young man who pledged, I mean, young man, young boy, he's 10 years old now, and he pledges his allowance. He pledges $10, $15. But he gets it. He likes the station. He actually listens to it. And I actually ran into him and his parents the other day, and this is a child who will come up to you and say, I just read this book today. He's read the entire book. He's a public radio person. And you, listeners, are public radio people, too. 428-1393 is the number. Give a call now. We're going to go into the interview right now with Ellen Augustine, who's a contributor to the book A Game as Old as Empire, The Secret World of Economic Hitmen and the Web of Global Corruption. Ellen Augustine, let's hit it. Many listeners to this program have heard and read John Perkins, author of the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman, to which this book is the sequel. Remind us of what an economic hitman is and tell us how the second book came together.
Okay, an economic hitman is a person who looks very much like a savvy business person. They have wonderful titles like economist, financial analyst, and yet what they do adds to keeping third world countries in a desperate cycle of poverty and filters untold millions to our multinational corporations and a small elite of wealthy people. Now, how A Game as Old as Empire came about is that when John was touring the country talking about Confessions of an Economic Hitman, people would say, oh, yeah, John, that's just you and a few bad corporations and banks and government officials. And John said, no, no, this is the modus operandi of the global financial system. So as the months went on, he began to speak with his publisher, Barrett Kohler, about how we needed to have another book which would show the whole gamut of how economic hitmen work. And this would be other economic hitmen, and it would be institutions that we think are altruistic, that we think are helping third world countries get out of poverty, like the World Bank and the IMF. And it would show all the different ways, from seemingly altruistic to the assassination of leaders, that the global financial structure is kept in place for the benefit of multinational corporations and a small global wealthy elite.
I mean, this is, it's big stuff. It's very hard for a lot of people to believe. A lot of people, when John Perkins' book came out, didn't believe it because his stories couldn't be corroborated. Have you had more whistleblowers or other actual so-called economic hitmen come forward, and are they represented in this book?
We have had more EHMs come forward and more whistleblowers. They are in this book. And what this book is it's totally referenced and resourced, so people can know for sure that this spans many different leaked government documents, many other people's writings. This is not just John Perkins and a few people. And the great thing about A Game as Old as Empire is it's written in a way that regular people can understand it. And this is very important because information that we need to have as informed citizens to make the crucial decisions about our lives and for the benefit of our children, this information has pretty much been kept from us. So John started out the expose of this with Confessions of an Economic Hitman, but as your readers know, he ended his career in that in the early 1980s. And since that time, the economic hitman culture has become ever more pervasive and destructive. And so A Game as Old as Empire brings it right up to the current moment in a way that's understandable for people.
Your chapter of the book, A Game as Old as Empire, is about the World Bank and its effect on the Philippines. Let's start with the very basic question. What is the World Bank? Is it a government agency? Is it private? Who runs it? And who's making money?
Okay, the World Bank is an agency that came into being, I guess, maybe 40 years or so ago. It's supported by taxpayer money, but mostly by U.S. taxpayers. And the U.S. government has a very large impact on what happens in it because an American is always the president of the World Bank.
Why is that, by the way? Why is an American always the president?
I'm not sure of that question, but I know that by tradition it always is. A European is always the president of the International Monetary Fund, and an American is always the president of the World Bank. And from leaked government documents, it's shown that the American government considers the World Bank an instrument of American foreign policy. So this is definitely ours to know about and to take some actions on. And I'd like to say that, you know, the topics of this, global economic hitmen and all these big national banks and corporations and things, many people would think like, ooh, wow, way beyond me, over my head. But this is not true. There are things that we can do in our everyday lives, and I want to weave those into the rest of our discussion so that people know in our name these atrocities do not have to continue to be committed, that when we can take simple actions in our life to bring integrity to the World Bank and to this global financial system, that it will better our lives as well as the third world people who are most desperately impacted. The other thing that's really crucial about this is that the corporations who are the major beneficiaries of these policies, they get their money by transporting components to poor third world countries like the Philippines and 100 other countries. They then assemble the products there and they ship them all the way back here. Now, one of the things that's on most everybody's mind, except for perhaps the Bush administration, is global warming. And global transport of goods is killing the planet. Is this what we want for ourselves and our children?
You mean transporting goods, for example, transporting parts by boat and then products in the other direction is using up that much fossil fuel?
Exactly. And fossil fuel is one of the major contributors to global warming.
Now, and we can get back to that in a moment, I wanted to stick with the World Bank for a second and this question of who funds it. Is the World Bank not self-sustaining? I mean, it's a bank. Is it actually funded by U.S. taxpayer dollars?
It is actually funded by U.S. taxpayer dollars, and it is not self-supporting. Part of the reason is because many of the loans that they give out, they know for sure that much of the money is going to be siphoned off. And when the money is siphoned off and can't be repaid, well, at least a fifth, probably more like a quarter or a third of World Bank loans, are never repaid, so they can't be self-sustaining. The loans are made to dictators, to corrupt dictators. The money gets siphoned off to them, their cronies, and their families, so that it's not a sustaining venue.
The World Bank economic model is called liberalization, and many of our listeners would probably consider themselves liberal. What does liberalization mean in an economic context?
Liberalization is part of the world of doublespeak. Now, most people who have not studied economics think, okay, liberal, the root is, in common usage, liberal means progressive and imbued with compassion for the less fortunate. Well, when you put that term into economic terms, it goes completely in the opposite direction. Liberalization means removing the barriers to the efficient functioning of the marketplace. That means poor countries have to eliminate their tariffs and reduce the regulations of their size of the government. And in Reagan's memorable terms, this means unleashing the magic of the marketplace. The trouble is, though, that these policies only work in the books. The countries that have been forced to take these policies on are all more desperate than they were 30 years ago or so when these policies started.
Now, it's an amazing statement that you make in your chapter in A Game as Old as Empire, namely that no country has ever developed successfully using the World Bank model of development. Why does the model not work?
The model doesn't work because it works with corrupt dictators and because it's set up, it's deliberately set up for the benefit of our multinational corporations and our international banks, especially their offshore branches. Let me tell you what happens. When these countries have loans, in for about 25 years, they were called structural adjustment loans, and over 90 countries were forced to take these loans. When they do that, they have to create export processing zones. Now, these are solely for the exclusive use of our multinational corporations. So what this means is these poor countries have to borrow millions of dollars to set up these areas where the multinationals can come, bring the components, and put their products together. So they have to build the buildings. They have to bring in the infrastructure, the water, the electricity, the telecommunications. They can only charge low rents to the multinationals using these spaces. They have to pass special laws that say that in these zones that the corporations can pay the people who are working less than their country's minimum wage. Now, minimum wage in any country is not geared so that anyone can really live on it.
Including in the United States.
Exactly. Can you imagine these companies that are multi-billion dollar companies paying less than minimum wage? So that, and when they do this also in these, when they use these export processing zones, there is no lease. So that any time they can find another third world country that's even more poor and desperate, they simply pick up and leave. Any time that the people in that first country say, we'd like a few more cents per hour, these multinationals pick up and leave.
You mentioned a couple of times that a lot of the money goes into the hands of corrupt dictators. Does the World Bank ever make loans to democracies that aren't run by dictators?
Well, most of the third world countries are not strong democracies. They don't have a long tradition of being able to manage themselves through elections like we have. Of course, our elections are compromised now, too. Nor do they have the class of entrepreneurs to run these. So that, really, no, it's the loans are all made to countries that have petty dictators, and the it's just known that most of my, it's called, let's see, what is their term? It's just an, how business is done. They expect that a lot of the loan is going to be siphoned off to the corrupt dictator, their cronies, and their family members.
And Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines is a prime example of that.
Yes, Ferdinand Marcos and his wife Imelda siphoned off at least $10 billion, possibly $15 billion. And the real tragedy about this is that while Ferdinand was siphoning off billions of dollars, he was still taking out more loans from the World Bank, the IMF, and other banks and export credit agencies. And these were going into projects like the Bataan Nuclear Power Plant, which was a horrible idea in the first place because it was built at the base of an active volcano. So luckily, this plant never went online. But the cost, the loan for it, the expense of it is still being paid by the Filipino people. You know, Ferdinand Marcos was ejected by his country, by people power, in 1986. And yet the Philippines are still paying off the loans that he took out. And as a matter of fact, 80 to 90% of their tax revenues goes to debt repayment. This is not just the Philippines. The reason why this chapter on the Philippines is so important is because it's a picture of what happens to all the other 90, 100, 120 other poor countries that are being subjected to these same kinds of loans and conditionalities.
You're listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, and this is an interview with Ellen Augustine. The book is called A Game as Old as Empire, The Secret World of Economic Hitmen and the Web of Global Corruption. And she's one of the many amazing contributors to this book. You can get the book. You can get a copy of this book for a contribution of $75 right now, this hour only, to KSFR. For $35, you can get a copy of the interview itself, which is, as usual, longer in real life than we're going to have time to play here. And for $100, you can get the book and the CD set of two things. 428-1393. Report from the control room.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. This is a great interview, actually.
Thank you.
Let's see. We have Lynn Einliger to thank.
Thank you, Lynn.
And then John Tapia.
Thank you, John. Let's get more people. Let's get the phones ringing. Get a copy of this book. We actually have 25 copies of this book, A Game as Old as Empire, the sequel to The Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Let's get all 25 of those out from our offices into your hands. 428-1393. Charlie Romney Brown.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. In listening to this interview, I think it we all become more aware of how important it is to learn the facts. And Mary Charlotte and Radio Cafe is giving us that opportunity. The only way a democracy can continue to exist is to have an educated populace. And I think that so many of us have been involved and worrying about our own problems that some of us have failed to be aware of what's really going on in the world. And let's be perfectly honest, there have been a lot of secrets that have been kept. And to be able to expose what's really happening is such a gift to the public. And so support Mary Charlotte, support Radio Cafe, so she can keep these very valuable interviews coming. It's the only way that we, as a country, can continue to function in the most positive fashion.
428-1393 is the number. Laurel.
Mary Charlotte, we have a challenge from the control room.
Ooh.
A guest or a listener who has already pledged is making a challenge of $1,500 if we can match that by 9 o'clock.
$1,500, ladies and gentlemen, 15 calls that get the book and the CD, and we're done. 428-1393, let's rise to the occasion. Give within your means. If you can afford the $35 and just get the CD, whatever it takes, 428-1393. You know, what you said, Charlie, a moment ago reminded me of, You know how when you graduate from high school or college or whatever, they give a graduation speech and you never remember it? I had one graduation speech in which the speaker, and I don't even remember who it was talking about individualism. And we all know about America and individualism, but he put it in a way that I hadn't thought of before. And he said, individualism isn't just worrying about yourself. It's worrying about yourself and your family and the people you know well to the exclusion of the larger community. And I understood then very, very quickly that I had to reach, and we all have to reach, outside of those people we know and love the most. Yes, we take care of those people we know and love the most. We don't sacrifice them in the service of something greater. But to just give that token gift, or gift of your time, or gift of your heart, and in this case, gift of your pledge to public radio, it's something greater, it's something outside of yourself, and it's something that binds the community together.
Absolutely. There's no question about it. It's so important that we pull, especially right now, Mary Charlotte, I think we've all become aware of the fact that maybe certain things have begun to slip as far as the government is concerned. And the only way that we can keep them on track is by being educated voters. And so we need to support KSFR. We need to support Mary Charlotte and her radio cafe for the fabulous job she's doing in keeping us.
Thank you.
In keeping us educated. Because, you know, the minute we go to sleep, the minute we cease to be, we can lose it all.
It's about constant vigilance, essentially.
It's constant vigilance. That's right.
428-1393 is the number. 428-1393. We're going to go back to Ellen Augustine now. We'll be back in a few minutes. Just in the first couple of moments, make that call, and let's match that $1,500 challenge. It's a very generous challenge. I know we can do it. We've done it in past days. Let's do it now. 428-1393. Back now to Ellen Augustine.
Dead poets come to life, art dances with drama, students spar with the written word, and music shares the stage with film. The third annual Poem Palooza, a poetry-based extravaganza hosted by the College of Santa Fe, showcases poetry in all its eclectic forms. Join students, faculty, and staff from CSF and local New Mexico high schools as they explore poetry with a twist on Wednesday, March 28th at 7 p.m. in the Greer Garson Theater. The College of Santa Fe is a tax-exempt organization. KSFR programming is underwritten by Locals Care. Locals Care community cards reward you for shopping and dining at over 100 locally owned businesses. You can support a Santa Fe nonprofit and earn rewards for yourself at any Locals Care business. Find program information and a current list of participating businesses and nonprofits at locals-care.com. Offered in cooperation with the Santa Fe Alliance and sponsored by Century Bank, Los Alamos National Bank, the New Mexican, and the City of Santa Fe.
When the United States was a developing country, which is not necessarily in, you know, your or my memory, but nevertheless, it's the historical record, how did it achieve successful development?
This is a really interesting story, because even up to the early 1930s and 40s, the United States had heavy protective tariffs for its products. And this is, of course, what we say to these other countries: you have to remove all tariffs on imported goods. The United States not only had the heavy protective tariffs up through World War II, but we violated all of the intellectual property rights that we now hold sacred. In the 1900s, the U.S. was notorious for printing the works of foreign authors without giving them any royalties. And our chemical industry got started after World War I when we stole German patents. So the question is, if it wasn't good medicine for us to follow these same policy prescriptions that the World Bank is setting forth now for the poor countries of the world, if it wasn't good medicine for us, why is it such good medicine for the rest of the world now?
You know, there are other factors, and it makes one so sad to read about these countries like the Philippines and to look at the details, but there are other factors that work against a country's achieving prosperity. For example, in this very World Bank policy of setting up these export zones, export processing zones, there was a policy against actually using educated laborers, such as engineers, from
the host country, which would foster a class of semi-well-paid employees.
Exactly. That's how a third world country could really use this to develop themselves. But instead, these multinationals bring in their own engineers. They don't use engineers from the country. They don't buy components or any of their resources from the third world country. So essentially, the components come in and the technological know-how. They use labor, which is skilled labor, but paid very cheaply, and then the products go out. Now, also as a part of this, the multinationals get tax holidays from the third world countries. So they're paying less than minimum wage. They're not paying taxes. And the thing about loans from the World Bank and the IMF and these other banks, they have to be repaid in the world currency, like the U.S. currency or euro dollars. They cannot be repaid in the country's own currency. So this is why these countries stay in a cycle of debt. It's almost impossible for them to get out. And you know what's really tragic about this is people still think that the money is flowing mostly from the wealthier northern countries down to the poorer southern countries. But studies are now showing that 20 times the amount of money comes up from the south to the global north, our multinationals and our banks and our wealthy elites, then goes to those countries. So these loans have been repaid again and again and again. So that when the movements like Jubilee, which is asking for debt forgiveness, it's not like we're giving away something. It's not that we're losing. These countries have all paid their debts again and again and again.
If the numbers really don't work out, that's something that, you know, a reasonably well-trained Filipino economist could have figured out at the get-go. In other words, if we accept a loan on this these terms and so on and so on, we're not going to be able to pay it back. Why do they do it anyway?
Well, they do it because the economists of these countries are educated in Western, in American and European universities. The standard for economic functioning and developing economic protocol is policies like liberalization. So the experts come back, the countrymen come back to their own countries, and they're indoctrinated that this is what works. The other thing is the Philippines and most other third world countries have joined the World Trade Organization. They've signed on to the international treaty called GATT, and the administrative arm of this is the World Trade Organization. When you are a member of the World Trade Organization, you have to agree to policies of liberalization. That is, the export processing zones, taking your tariffs off your books, so that these countries, even though a lot of people in these third world countries are waking up, and globally, there are thousands of organizations in third world countries who are saying, no, this is a raw deal for us. You know, third world countries need to resign en masse from organizations like WTO because it's not helping them at all. But this is a wave that's cresting. It's not there yet. Now, how we can help this happen is through actions that we take. For example, you know, these countries are kept under this thumb because they've got to put all of their laws to the benefit of the multinationals, to export-led development is what that's called. So if we in our country, instead of buying from these multinationals that are shipping these products, you know, thousands of vials and killing the planet and giving only starvation wages, if instead we say, I'm going to buy local, I'm going to take the time to go to my local farmer's market, I'm going to see who in my community is a local vendor, a local maker of products, and local is defined as within about 100 to 150 miles. And there's organizations like Co-op America, which has a lovely publication called The Green Pages. So you can look up in there for items like clothing, household supplies, office supplies. You can see where in your own area sustainably produced products are made. So when people do that, we take the profits away from the multinationals from doing this kind of system. Now, what happens in third world countries when we do that is that instead of them being forced to put all their money into building these export processing zones for the multinationals and to giving them tax holidays, they can put the taxes that they collect from their own countries into supporting their own businesses. There's also another book that's very interesting that I think you may want to talk to the author if you haven't already. Michael Schumann wrote a book called The Small Mart Revolution, and he talks about how in this country, municipalities that are choosing to give small targeted grants and help to their local companies rather than to paying for Walmart, like paying for the infrastructure to go out to the outside of the town where Walmart is, instead of giving Walmart a tax holiday. These municipalities start to have thriving local communities, and the businesses that they just give a little help to then support their people because the money stays in that area. The people have good jobs that are living wage, that they enjoy coming to, that they have a say about what happens. So it's a win-win all the way around. So if people start to think locally, think locally in your own town, this will help people in the third world countries also.
What about I've thought about this myself. I wanted to buy a pair of pants one day, and somebody said, oh, go buy the pants that aren't made with sweatshop labor, and they cost 2 to 3 times as much. Is there an economic model whereby sustainably and fairly produced goods are competitive with everything else?
Well, you know what? If they put the cost of global warming in the pants that you can buy for one half the cost, that pant would be off the charts expensive. We have to start thinking, what do we really want? You know, with our dollars, we are very, very powerful. And even though a pair of pants or a blouse may cost twice the amount, if you buy it sustainably made, do you want to support a company that is paying their workers less than minimum wage and killing the planet with global warming? You know, the other thing that's real interesting about this is we're now starting to see longitudinal studies about are people happy. And as people, we've certainly had a flood of consumer goods in this country in the past few decades, but steadily the happiness index has been going down. It shows that after a certain modicum level of comfort is reached, more stuff does not make us more happy. So as we start thinking about, okay, well, maybe I don't need 10 pairs of pants in my wardrobe. Maybe I can get by with 5 that are quite versatile. It's a sense of integrity and authenticity that begins to grow within ourselves, that begins to grow in the business community, and starts to make it fair trade around the world, and starts to make a planet that there'll be something left that's worth leaving to our children.
That is all fine and good from a middle-class point of view. Many, many people in even our country live in serious poverty and can't even afford to make those choices.
Everybody does not have to do this. I agree with you. There's probably 20% of this country that is living in serious poverty. There's probably another 30 or 40% that are just barely making ends meet. But there's probably 40 to 50% of the country that can make these choices. When these people start using their economic clout, then you will see big changes.
Let's go back to the World Bank for a moment. The question of debt cancellation has come up a lot in the last couple of years. Is there a movement toward debt cancellation on the part of the World Bank for a country like the Philippines?
No, there isn't. At the World Bank's annual meeting about a year ago, they decided on debt cancellation for 18 of the world's very poorest countries. And there were probably about 70 or 80 countries that really needed debt cancellation, but the World Bank and the banks in other wealthy countries gave debt cancellation to 18 countries. Of course, they did this with strings. These people had to cut their education and health care budgets within their own countries, plus other things. So it didn't even come for free. The World Bank's, even though 80 to 90% of their taxes goes to paying back these loans, the World Bank is still considered a moderately indebted country. Is this unbelievable?
Wait, say that again?
Right. At using 80 to 90% of their tax revenues to pay back World Bank, IMF, and other loans, they are considered a moderately indebted country, and they are not eligible for debt cancellation.
The Philippines.
The Philippines, that's right. so that to run their own government and their own social services, they have to constantly take out new loans.
You're listening to Ellen Augustine. The book is called A Game as Old as Empire, right here on KSFR, the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. We're going to take a quick break right now to implore you to call 428-1393 and make your pledge. Ellen Augustine herself said, with our dollars, we are powerful. With our dollars, we can choose what kind of media we want. I often lament. I have Dish, you know, satellite Dish on the ceiling, on the roof of my house. And sometimes I just want to watch TV. There's nothing on. There's just nothing to watch. I mean, you can watch, advertisement channel. You can watch endless reruns of Law and Order, which is about the best thing that's on. You can watch prepackaged news, which doesn't tell you anything. You can watch unbelievably bad reality shows. You can pay a whole lot extra and get HBO, which I don't have. With your dollars, ladies and gentlemen, you can actually choose the media you want that have substantial news, that have substantial programs on them, that have really interesting music. How do you do this? It's easy. You call 428-1393.
Mary Charlotte, in listening to that interview, I became aware of what a fabulous, once again, I'm aware every time I listen to you, what a fabulous job you do in picking up these authors to interview them to educate us. I mean, what she was telling us is that the World Bank, this wonderful expose of the World Bank, I lived in Washington for many years. I didn't realize this about the World Bank. I had to listen to your interview here in Santa Fe to find out about it. And what it is saying is that we are helping other countries by buying locally. Goodness knows we are helping our local merchants by buying locally. And we are also helping the heating of the world and global warming by buying locally. Three very, very imposing reasons to listen to Mary Charlotte, who is giving us this information. It's absolutely extraordinary, Mary Charlotte. You are to be congratulated.
Well, thank you. And Ellen Augustine and all the people who are doing this work, who are actually going out and doing this research. I mean, I'm sitting in a chair in the cafe sipping coffee. We've got a report from the control room.
Absolutely, Mary Charlotte. We have many thank yous to give here.
Oh, good.
One from Diane Granito. Thank you very much for
Diane.
Your pledge. We had a pledge from Denise Cope.
Thank you, Denise.
Sandra Place called in with her pledge.
Thank you, Sandra.
And then we got a special thanks from Marty Rosenberg.
Oh, thank you, Marty.
And he encourages all Santa Fe Film Festival members to pledge today.
And he was on the program yesterday talking about film. Have we yet reached our $1,500 goal?
No, actually, after I made that announcement, someone came in and then amended that to being a challenge that is a noontime challenge. But we still have a long way to go to meet that. So
noontime, schmoontime. Let's do it right now. 428-1393. Let's get 15 calls in the next 15 minutes.
Right. And then we have just a few more thank yous. Mary Lee, thank you.
Thank you.
And Kristen and Casey Ryan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And one more thank you to Greg Swift.
Well, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Now, there are many, many more of you who are listening right now and who I know for a fact like the show. If you like the show, put your money where your mouth is. Call right now, 428-1393. You will be thanked on the air, or not if you don't want to. We can just say that somebody sent in an anonymous pledge. 428-1393. We're going to hear from one of our underwriters and then back to Ellen Augustine.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by Garcia Street Books, located at 376 Garcia Street, where Santa Fe author Lynn Stegner will launch her newest novel, Because a Fire Was in My Head, on Friday, March 30th at 5 o'clock. And on Saturday, March 31st, from 1 to 3 o'clock, Diane Pardue, author of Shared Images, and Native American jewelry artists Yazzie Johnson and Gail Bird will sign copies as well as exhibit jewelry. More information at 986-0151 or garciastreetbooks.com.
The World Bank is full of bright, dedicated, well-intentioned people. Do you think that they know and support the story that you're telling?
Actually, in A Game as Old as Empire, there is a wonderful chapter by Steve Berkman. Steve worked with the World Bank for 16 years, and by his estimate, likely a third of the money in the bank goes to the corrupt dictators. Steve says that, yes, there are good people in the World Bank. people who want to do good, but they know that this isn't working, but they've got golden handcuffs. They've got mortgages to pay. They've got kids in college. And this is a bureaucracy that's got a momentum. The rationale is often, gee, you know, if I give up this six-figure job, there's another 100 people at the door waiting to take it. I might as well take it and take care of my family. It's very sad.
It's very sad indeed. What kind of policies do you think would meet the actual needs of the citizens of the Philippines and other countries in a similar economic position? And would those policies have to come from the grassroots of that country?
Well, these policies have got to start with not only the grassroots of the people in the Philippines, but also with people in this country. The first thing that we really need to do is debt cancellation. Because, as I said, 20 times more money is flowing up from the poor countries than goes down to them. And there's an organization called Jubilee USA, where they not only lobby the World Bank and American officials. The World Bank meets two times a year at big meetings. And so if you join, if you go to JubileeUSA.org, you can be a part of that organization and do the smallest of things, like send a postcard to World Bank officials before their meeting. Send a postcard or an email to an American official saying, ha, we know, this is our money. No, we don't want this being done in our name. So it's a wellspring of things that are happening, both in this country as well as by unifying with people around the world. You know what's really exciting is that we do have the Internet now. We do have communication. There are many, there are thousands and thousands of organizations who are working on this. We've got the World Social Forum that meets every couple of years, and at their meeting they have 100,000 people from countries all around the world who are thinking, what do we want? And the thrust of it must be for local sustainable economies. So when we have debt forgiveness, we say to these countries, yes, you can start now putting your resources toward developing your own country. You don't have to be paying back this debt which has already been repaid. And we can then focus on that in our own country, too.
One of the things you didn't go into so much in the essay in your book, but that I was thinking about, was the extent to which policies that bring a lot of people from rural areas into factories affect the quality of rural life and, in fact, causes a breakdown of the village system and things like that. How did that play out in the Philippines?
Well, a lot of people left the rural areas to come to the cities because when GATT and WTO, when GATT and WTO came into effect in the mid-1990s, the Philippines were told that they would have 500,000 new jobs per year. So, of course, people left the rural areas to come to the cities. This did not happen. Instead, tens of thousands of people lost their jobs. So, and it has made the impact of these global trade policies also has allowed agricultural products from countries like the U.S., where agriculture is heavily subsidized, those come in, and the few Filipino farmers that are still left, their prices are undercut. They can't possibly compete. The average Filipino farmer gets $13 worth of subsidies from their government. The average American farmer gets $15,000. So this has had an utterly devastating effect on farmers as well as city people in the Philippines, and repeat this story for the other developing world.
So it's actually cheaper for a Filipina housewife to buy American beans than homegrown Philippine beans of the same kind?
That's right. Sad but true.
Yeah.
In the Philippines right now, it's so desperate that they now have they sell foods predominantly in very tiny cans. A 4-ounce can is the most popular size on the shelf because people have become so poor they can only afford to buy food in that tiny quantity. You know, just to let you know, people know, of course, about, they've heard about how desperate garment workers are. And then they've also heard that many American clothing companies say, oh, no, we have a code of conduct that's put into place. Well, let me tell you about one Filipino worker. And Elvira, she's a garment worker, and she works 12 to 16-hour days. Sometimes she works even overnight if there's a big demand. And the pressure on her is so great that during her break, she does not go to the restroom nor eat, because it would mean that she couldn't make her quota. Now, the code of conduct is indeed posted upon the wall, but it's never enforced. When representatives from the big American company come in, the workers are told, if you are asked what you make, you tell them this much. And if the workers don't say that, they're fired. So Elvira, for working 12 to 16-hour days, makes, and 6 days a week, she makes between 500 and 1,000 pesos a week, depending on how much work there is that week. To put this into perspective, a kilo, which is approximately 2 pounds, a kilo of fish costs 150 pesos. A kilo of tomatoes costs 75 pesos, and a kilo of papayas costs 25. So add that up, and between 2 pounds each of fish, tomatoes, and papayas, that is more than half her paycheck on a week when she earns 500 pesos. This is the system that is being kept in place by these policies.
And so that doesn't count. That doesn't count housing, transportation, or anything else that it
That's right.
is required to live. You know, for all the social justice movements in the world, the big question remains, how do you address and prevent the corruption that comes with power, whether it be dictators or, you know, drug lords, military-industrial complex leaders, corporate types, or for that matter, the state cops? You know, these people are ubiquitous, and it seems that it takes thousands of ordinary people to stop any single one of them.
You know what? The people that have the welfare and the common good of their own countrymen in mind, unfortunately, in this system of economic hitmen, they are taken out of power. So, and that's also covered in a game as old as Empire. However, there are countries that are starting to have leaders that are being able to stand up to this system, to say, no, we're going to repay 25 cents on the dollar. We're going to start taking control of our own country and our resources. And, of course, this is being led by Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, and then also Ecuador, Bolivia, Chile, Cuba, and Brazil. They all have more progressive governments in place. So it change is happening on all kinds of levels. People are being swept into power who are saying that we need something else. We need to be able to live and have hope in our own country. So when you have that, you have people in the third world who are electing these types of leaders, and you have people in this country who are also starting to take a stand against corporatization. In 1998, in Pennsylvania, the Wayne Township passed an ordinance forbidding any corporation with three or more regulatory violations over 7 years to establish operations in their township. In 2006, in California's Humboldt County, they banned out-of-county corporations from making any political contributions in local elections. In Maryland, they recently passed legislation requiring that any company with 10,000 employees or more has to spend at least 8% of their payroll on health care benefits. And, of course, the only company that fit this bill was Walmart. So people in third world countries are making their initiatives, doing what they can, and people in our country are doing the same. And also, it's alliances are so important between consumers, between we who buy the products, between we who enjoy the products, and those people who make them. Probably not too many of your listeners know about the victory that was won by farm workers in this country in Florida with Taco Bell Foods. There grew up a connection between the farm workers who picked the tomatoes for Taco Bell and their chief target, which was high school and college students. And this was something that evolved over 10 years. Over 300 colleges and 50 high schools started a ban, a boycott of Taco Bell Foods and their parent company, Yum Brands, which, of course, had many other brands of foods. So finally, after 10 years, Taco Bell gave these farm workers their first raise in 25 years.
Heavens.
So whether you want to put your effort towards something that's happening in your locality in this country, whether you want to cheer on people in the third world and spread the good news about what is happening, change is rising up. You know, it's not in the headlines, though. Why? Because the major media outlets are owned by by these multinational corporations. And that's why it's so important for you during your fund drive to have every person who's listening to this say, yeah, you know what? Paying $50 or $75 or $100 to give it to your station is a small price to pay so that I can have this type of information, this information that gives me both ideas to act and hope that we can have a different world for our children and grandchildren.
And if, ladies and gentlemen, this is it, 428-1393. Charlie Romney Brown has been spending the hour with us, very kindly listening to the interview, and this is the number to call, 428-1393. If you want a copy of the book, A Game as Old as Empire, with the essay by Ellen Augustine, whom we just heard speaking. And it is the number to call if you want to make your contribution to real media, not phony media. You want the actual meat, potatoes, broccoli, and tofu of media, as opposed to the frosting, fluff, and spray-on marshmallow. Charlie Romney Brown is the founder of Women's Voices. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
It's my pleasure, Mary Charlotte. I would just like to give you two quotes to echo what Ellen was saying. And that's, I think so often we as citizens feel impotent. Well, let me give you these quotes. All that is necessary for evil to succeed is that good men do nothing.
And women.
And women, absolutely. And then I'd like to quote Margaret Mead, all it takes is a few good citizens to change the world.
That's
right.
And
indeed, that is the only way it has ever happened. This is your chance to help change the world. Support Mary Charlotte, her wonderful program. Please make a donation right now.
428-1393 is the number. And Women's Voices, which we will talk about some other time. We'll get you back on the air
to talk about all the great work
that you're doing. But you can always call Charlie Romney Brown and Women's Voices at 424-0884. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe on the web at ksfr.org. 428-1393 is the pledge line number, 428-1393. We will see you tomorrow. More interviews with amazing people. And thank you so much for listening. And pledge now, 428-1393. Ciao.